Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. If you find benefit from this talk, please support the restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Human Buddha's Dhamma with your donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
And we'll start with the Kajaniya Sutta. I'm missing a piece. Hold on. You're missing a piece. There is a piece. The Kajaniya Sutta. Are the microphone levels okay?
Sounds good to me.
Thank you. Released from affliction. Samyutta Nikaya. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Savatthi. There he addressed those gathered. Friends, any Dhamma practitioner who directs their thinking to past lives are only recollecting one or all of the five clinging aggregates. The Buddha is tackling a subject here that was central in the society that he lived in, and it remains one of the central pillars of current Indian society, and more important for us, it's a central theme in most, maybe all, of the current forms of Buddhism. Quite a bit of that comes out of a misapplication of the Buddhist description of his own awakening. He explains there how the process of clinging to wrong views of self, leading to a renewed becoming and birth, even beyond this lifetime, became clear to him. He actually saw his previous chain of ignorance, suffering, and rebirth. This was then interpreted by later Dharmas as a prerequisite for awakening, as something to go looking for, and something to work on with special meditations and special practices and all that. Now, if you want to keep establishing your ego personality in realms outside of the here and now, that is, of course, an excellent excuse to do that. And in this sutta, the Buddha tells us that this is a bad idea. Believing in the importance of past lives can be a serious hindrance in developing the Dharma. Why? Because it basically takes away the whole of the Third Noble Truth. The cessation of stress is possible. If you believe that your current life with its stress and unhappiness is an inevitable consequence of what happened in past lives, then why would you bother developing the Dhamma, taking refuge in the Dhamma? The Dhamma is practiced here and now. Why would you bother with that when you're convinced that you're getting screwed by something that you already did a few lives ago? When we think this way, we are becoming. Attention is moving away from here and now. We are no longer present. We are becoming something else, somewhere else, some other time than here and now. and the roots of this becoming are in ignorance. From that becoming, as a requisite condition, comes birth. Actually, birthing, coming into being. What comes into being here? What is being brought forth? Anatta, our false sense of self, based in ignorance, sustained by clinging and craving, and fed by our unwillingness to be present in life, and hell-bent for disappointment, frustration, and suffering. In this sutta, the Buddha dismantles the whole notion that you should pay attention to your past lives, and that you should acquire lots of merit for better future lives. The Buddha speaks, friends, any Dhamma practitioner who directs their thinking to past lives are only recollecting one or all of the five clinging aggregates. Which five? When recollecting I was one with such a form in the past, one is only recollecting form. When recollecting I was one with such a feeling in the past, one is only recollecting feeling. When recollecting I was one with such a perception in the past, one is only recollecting perceptions. When recollecting I was one with such a fabrication in the past, one is only recollecting fabrications. When recollecting I was one with such consciousness in the past, one is only recollecting consciousness. Then he goes on. Why is the form aggregate called form? Because it's afflicted. Form is afflicted with cold, hunger, thirst, wind, sun, bugs, and reptiles. Now, when I first read this part, I had a bit of a moment. And the rest of the description of the aggregates didn't help very much either. When I run into stuff like that in suttas, I kind of sneak back into the commentaries and what other people have seen here. It turns out that the Buddha was engaging in a bit of wordplay here. In Pali, it goes like this. Kincha bhikkhave rupam vadeta. Why, monks, is it called form? Rupati tiko bhikkhave. It is afflicted, monks. And all the monks go, rupa, rupati. Ah, yes, of course, make perfect sense. The Buddha is, of course, not just engaging in some clever wordplay here. He is pointing at the essential qualities of the aggregates, what makes us cling to them. We notice and cling to form when there is something going on that we don't want. Cold, hunger, bugs, you name it. As when the shoe fits, you can walk for miles without noticing your feet. You do the same thing in a pair of 4-inch stiletto heels, and you'll certainly find out where your feet are. The Buddha continues. And why is the feeling aggregate called feeling? Because it feels. It feels pleasure, pain, neither pleasure nor pain. We join with these feelings. We build up our identity with them to try and make them permanent, to cling to these aggregates. And why is the perception aggregate called perception? Because it perceives. It perceives blue, yellow, red, white. Those perceptions and our reaction to them add every time to this bird's nest of identity, this thing that looks like a solid thing. And when you look into a bird's nest, you'll see that it is made up of twigs, pieces of grass, a piece of a face mask, whatever they can find, and it all clings together in this really solid looking form. But it isn't, take one poke at it and it just falls apart. Buddha continues. Why is the fabrication aggregate called fabrication? Because it fabricates. It fabricates what is experienced as form, feeling, perceptions, consciousness. It fabricates fabrications. Independent origination. It starts out this way. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. Those fabrications are our distorted way of dealing with the world because we don't understand it. The Buddha continues. And why is the consciousness aggregate called consciousness? Because it cognizes, it thinks. It cognizes sour, sweet, bitter, pungent, salty, bland. Consciousness, ongoing thinking based on fabrications, based on a wrong understanding of reality. And what is this poor little consciousness going to do? It is going to rattle on about anything at all. That's what it does. So, friends, a well-instructed Dhamma practitioner understands, I'm now being afflicted by form. In the past, I was afflicted by form. If I delight in future form, I will likewise be afflicted with future form. So, there is nothing grand or cosmic about past and future lives. The same desires and aversions that drive our current stressful life, they drove our past lives, and they will continue to drive our future lives. They will also continue to cause the same afflictions and annoyances, suffering. Unless we follow the Buddha's example and take to the Dhamma like our hair is on fire. And our hair has been on fire for a very long time. The Buddha continues. Understanding, they become disenchanted with past and future form. They are now practicing the Dhamma to become disenchanted and dispassionate with present form. They are now practicing the Dhamma to develop cessation from clinging to present form. Once you get this disenchantment and dispassion, even a little bit, the spell fades, the spell we have put on ourselves. we see that we don't need to have our lives run by our likes and dislikes, our sacred passions. We practice the Eightfold Path for disenchantment and dispassion with our present form, so that we will also no longer be enchanted by past or future form. We will no longer try to build a nice, solid identity on that ever-changing form, past, present, or future. The Buddha continues, furthermore, this well-instructed Dharma practitioner understands, I am now afflicted by feelings, by perceptions, by fabrications, by consciousness. In the past, I was also afflicted by feelings, perceptions, by fabrications, and by consciousness. If I delight in future feelings, perceptions, fabrications, or consciousness, I will likewise be afflicted with future feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness. Understanding this, they become disenchanted with past and future feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness. They are now practicing the Dhamma to become disenchanted and dispassionate with present feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness. They are now practicing the Dhamma to develop cessation from clinging to present feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness. All those five clinging aggregates, the things that we try so hard to build that bird's nest out of, that we call ourselves, play the same role here, and the path guides us to understand them and eventually end relying on them for our happiness. So what do you think, friends? Is form permanent or impermanent? Are feelings, perceptions, fabrications, consciousness permanent or impermanent?
All are impermanent, Venerable Sir.
Thank you, Kevin. Great teacher, they are all impermanent. And is that which is impermanent easeful or stressful? What is impermanent is always stressful, great teacher. Friends, is it fitting to self-identify with which is impermanent and stressful? Always subject to change and uncertainty, as this is mine, this is me, this is what I am. Great teacher, it is not fitting to self-identify with what is impermanent and stressful and always subject to change and uncertainty, as this is me, this is mine, this is what I am. Friends, it is known by the wise that any form whatsoever that is past, present, or future, any form that is internal or external, any form that is obvious or subtle, any form that is common or sublime, any form near or far, should always be thought of through right view as this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. Furthermore, any feelings, perceptions, fabrications, or consciousness whatsoever, past, present, future, internal, external, obvious or subtle, common or sublime, near or far, should always be seen through right view as this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am. Friends, this is called a Dharma practitioner who diminishes rather than embellishes, who abandons rather than clings, who discards rather than acquires, and who scatters rather than pile up. He's describing here how we unidentify with these aggregates, how we loosen the bonds to it, our ties to it, our fascination with it. The wise Dharma practitioner diminishes feelings, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness rather than embellish these aggregates. The wise Dharma practitioner abandons form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness rather than cling to these aggregates. The wise Dharma practitioner discards form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness rather than acquire these aggregates. And the wise Dharma practitioner scatters form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, and consciousness rather than pile up these aggregates. Understanding impermanence with regard to these aggregates, the well-instructed Dharma practitioner grows disenchanted with form, disenchanted with feeling, disenchanted with perceptions, and they grow disenchanted with consciousness. Disenchanted, they become dispassionate. With dispassion established, there is release. Release from clinging to wrong views, ignorant of Four Noble Truths. Released, they know that they are released. They know that birth is ended. A life well integrated with the hardwood has been fulfilled. The task is complete. They know that there will be no further entanglements with the world. In essence, the only mindful thing to do when we catch the clinging aggregates at work in our daily life and on our cushion is to understand that they are not what they pretend to be. A permanent self that has been with us for lifetimes or even just this lifetime and will continue to do so in the future. We remind ourselves, pun intended, this is not mine. This body, these feelings, etc., have never been constant and will never be. Any attempt to make them permanent will result in a subtle but deep frustration. Take refuge in the Dharma. Practice the Eightfold Path, because the Eightfold Path was designed by the Buddha to show us where we make form, feeling, perceptions, fabrication, consciousness ours. He did not include right speech, right action, and right livelihood in the practice so that we would turn into nice Buddhists. The virtuous factors are there to challenge us so that we get to see where we cling to anger, resentment, fear, greed, lust, you name it. All the human qualities that stick together into this fragile bird's nest that we call ourself. This is not mine. This is not me. This is not myself. The Buddha continues. This, friends, is the Dharma practitioner who neither diminishes nor embellishes form, feeling, perceptions, and fabrications or consciousness, but who is now established in the Dharma, having abandoned. A wise Dharma practitioner, free of affliction. Friends, One who has released their mind from all wrong views is never afflicted again by speculation. This one is established in right view. So in this last part of the teaching, the Buddha describes the practitioners who have released their clinging, their identification with the five aggregates. These aggregates are now just aggregates, ways to interact with life as it comes along, not needing it to be any different than it is. Thank you.
That was excellent, Ram. I'm going to shut up and listen to the others, but you did a really wonderful job. Thank you.
Thank you.
Excellent job, Ram. Excellent job. You did an incredible job of unpacking the five clinging aggregates in such a fastidious way. I mean, I felt like we were looking at a watch with the gears, and it was just so precise. You did such a good job with that. And you tied it right into what we've been talking about for 2 days now, which is unbinding these views that embodied as five clinging aggregates. We need to figure out how to release. And that was just a brilliant explanation on how to do that. I really liked that you just highlighted at the end and in the teaching, there's no speculation left because we've encountered cessation. We've experienced it. We have the standard of the Dhamma, as John said in the first talk. We know that it works. We see it working. We, as you just said, we release that subtle dissatisfaction that comes from ignorance and wrong views. So thank you so much, Ram. Great job.
Thank you. And also, the Buddha speaks on past lives and future lives here, but the same mechanism happens right here in this life. You know, clinging to what happened 5 minutes ago, somebody ticked you off, your daddy didn't give you what you wanted, and you want to get the old red Ferrari.
We're not here. Somewhere else.
It's somewhere else. And
you did such a, like, again, you just, how it resolves here. It's up to us to figure it out, and we have a way to do it. So, excellent.
Thank you. Let's see. Josh, what do you think?
Wonderful, Ram. My mind is spinning right now. When you were talking about past lives and future lives, I was thinking that the Josh when he was 6 years old is not the same Josh as he is now.
Mm-hmm.
And I assume that even the Josh 10 seconds ago is not the same Josh as he is right now. And the difference is, I have a chance to get out of ignorance from now on as much as I can.
Yep.
And
I'm left.
And I thank goodness the Buddha came along and kind of gave us a roadmap to try to figure that out. But it was wonderful. I really followed more or less all the links, but I'm still working on that. thank you so much.
Yeah, they can be confusing concepts, but you'll find as you move into them, and the repetition, as we said many times, is important here, the clarity only gets better as you go through it again and again. These are all things that are woven together by the Buddha in a fantastic way. And it, as I've said before, it just never ceases to amaze me that he did that, out of his own little mind, well, not quite little, and that these truths that he understood and formulated are still with us. They're still here, and they are helpful in our lives. It is their truths. They're noble truths.
And Josh, I would just say that the important thing about to remember about dependent origination, especially early in practice, is not to memorize the entire sutta, but just to know that it's from ignorance of four noble truths that suffering arises. And that is described in the 12 links of dependent origination. But that's just to keep our focus on developing understanding of four noble truths, which this sutta teaches. Ram brought it out.
Yeah, and you can see that. I tried to do this in the beginning when I first ran into John first started teaching the dependent origination. I tried to get a grasp of the whole thing, and that's really difficult.
Yeah.
But you saw here that you take one or two aspects of dependent origination, and you follow that. And once you unravel that one link in the 12 chains, the whole thing falls apart like a bad sweater.
Yeah.
And we've been talking as a group on, you know, with all the talks and so far, as we've kind of been zeroing in on this main first one, a significant one is fabrication. And that's what Matt talked about. And that's what you were talking about, and that's what we're unbinding. Wrong views are fabrications.
Yeah, and to pick up on that, then thank you, Kevin, because it's something that was rattling around. One of the lines in there, to me, it's one of the most significant lines, is the wise Dhamma practitioner neither diminishes nor embellishes.
Yeah.
And so, in the context, that covers everything, doesn't it? Because it begins at the gross level. I'm no longer diminishing or embellishing anything in my life that I'm attached to. But then within the context of this particular sutta, which is really what the Buddha's teaching is to be authentic to the Dhamma in this sutta, is to neither diminish or embellish his Dhamma. That's what he's speaking to at its most basic form. And so when you think about why does the Buddha keep coming back to that theme, to neither diminish nor embellish his Dhamma, it's because he notices it even within his well-focused sangha, the compulsion to do that, and they would do it in all the ways that we know today, overemphasizing certain words that might make a point for them, that might cover something that they hope excuse me that they hope to hold on to. And so even within the Dhamma, we'll try to make the Dhamma our own, and then do things like write a whole new book called the Abhidhamma. Or we'll create concepts that we want to embellish the Dhamma with, such as Buddha nature or Buddhahood, or the what Jen was talking about yesterday, these speculative realms that we hope to establish ourselves in. We give them flowery labels so they sound like, wow, that's something great, like the dimension of infinite consciousness or infinite space, or neither perception nor non-perception, and the other ones that I mentioned, Buddhahood or Buddha nature. All of those are what the Buddha is referring to here. That is embellishing the Dhamma, and even though it sounds good, we don't do it. You know, we keep it very pure.
It's David.
There's David.
It's on an everyday basis. It's the embellishment by, because what we're talking about is fear. We're talking about fear of these common everyday anxieties, and they're embellishing, even if they're in the practice, by hiding or running or freezing, all those natural human responses to fear. And then you pile on some, you know, prescription drugs or denial or alcohol and all that at the same time, having the practice. And truly, the practice is enough. There's a nice little ending to the Four Noble Truths, where if you're true to it, it will provide those answers and that practice, and you combine that with the rigor, and then you'll see the anxieties and the fears understood, not go away, because there's the world out there, but really it's the understanding, and then understanding that it's not personal.
Well said, David.
Jane, how are you doing there?
I'm fine, thank you. I appreciate the pace of your teaching. It allowed me to make the connections I needed to, you know, in my own life. I appreciate that a lot. And the other part I really liked was when you said, take to the Dhamma like your hair is on fire.
Mm-hmm.
When I took the time I started my Dhamma practice, I really did feel that way. And my hair was on fire. And it has brought a lot of calm and peace. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Jen, what do you think?
Oh man, I just love listening to you, Ram. I your cadence, and I like the word that Kevin used, you're fastidious. You're just, every single word you say is thought out and meaningful, and it just cuts right through conditioned thinking and just hands it to you. Here it is. And then your sense of humor too is just so just spot on, just crystal clear. So, thank you so much.
Yeah, I learned that sense of humor partly from John. Well, not that I learned it from him, but the importance of it. And actually, my old guru as well, Osho, was a hoot on when he was teaching. He would come up with these, actually people would send him these zingers of jokes, and he would just sit there with this completely passive face, and he would just lay out these jokes just to, and it's, you know, it keeps the audience with you, and it's, you know, there's a danger of taking things too seriously.
Yep.
Right.
And a little joke in there from time to time is, it really works.
Yeah. It works for me for sure, because I definitely tend towards the too serious.
And one of the things that's so remarkable about our Sangha, whether it's on retreat or just in Frenchtown, is we're all so quick to laugh, and you have to. You know, the Buddha is really pointing out the absurdity of living a life rooted in fabrications. It is. It's absurd. The things that we decide are true, and we follow them. And when you see the reality of it, you really see the absurdity of it. You got to laugh at it.
Yeah. And you never see an all-out laugh in the suttas, but you see quite a few little chuckles.
Yeah.
The humor gives it lift and air, you know, buoyant. It keeps this up in the air. We're able to work with it. Otherwise, it's
fun to learn the truth. You know, it is. And so when you contrast it to things that you used to believe and hold as true, it really is. It's hilarious when I think of the things that I thought were so important. Beginning with a fresh cheap bottle of vodka every day was the most important thing in my life, right. and it was for a long time. That's absurd, isn't it? And it's devastating to live that life, but to look back at the thought process, is hilarious that a human being would actually think that way, and literally think themselves to death because of holding on to beliefs. And it's not just addiction; we do it with all types of things.
Everything.
Yes, Jen.
Mike, how are you doing there?
Hi, Ram. How are you? I loved your presentation. Just to echo what I think it was Jane who said your pace, and I think it was a Jen, the cadence. I just loved the way you presented. it was just such a nice listen, the way you just presented it. And also, you know, what I really got out of this, you know, and this is, I think, is extremely important, and it's something, you know, very special about the way you presented this, is that I actually, when you explained, you know, I think I have a pretty good grasp on the aggregates, but when you explained them the way you did, I actually began to feel disenchanted and dispassionate as you went through them. It actually permeated my being when you were explaining them in that the manner that you were. It was really a penetrating, you know, presentation you had there. So I just, again, thank you very much, and excellent job. And you know what? I just love the amount of wisdom you have. You really are a man of wisdom, and I'm just, again, I'm gracious for your, you know, your presentation.
Yeah.
And to have you as a teacher and a guide. Thank you so much.
And thank you all for allowing me to teach you, because the process of teaching forces this investigation, which is only to my own benefit. And you know, and I've said this in my bio too. I started this process of becoming a teacher because I wanted this focus on understanding. And there is nothing that sharpens your understanding like the necessity and the push to teach this to others. You cannot, I won't allow anything to come out of my mouth or my pen that isn't clear. You know, my critical mind picks that up right away and rejects it. No, I can't put that out. This is not clear. If it's not clear to me, then it will not be clear to somebody else. You know, they can fake it, but I'm not going to fake this.
Well, this presentation was a testimony to that, because it came across extremely clear. Yes, my heartfelt. Yeah.
It's working.
Thank you. It's working, yes.
Yeah. Thank you. Julia?
Hi, Ron. Thank you so much for your teaching. It was very beautiful the way you presented everything. I like how, the same as everyone else was saying, Jane and Michael, that when you spoke, you had such a good pace. I also liked how when you spoke the Buddha's words, you said it with such conviction. It sounded as though you embodied the Buddha for that particular moment. It was very, very good. And also, I enjoyed like a couple of the things that when you were speaking, that the hair on fire was one of those that leaves like an image. And also when you said it breaks the spell of our fascination, I was like, yes, I understand that. You made it clear. So I appreciate the way you presented the whole lesson. Thank you so much, Ron.
Thank you. Trevor?
Ram, great appreciation to you. So grateful. Like others, I really enjoy your patient and methodical and very authentic style. It was just like, this is who I am, and I'm going to be who I am here as I walk through this sutta. And I think you kind of reiterated that just now when you said, it's not about faking anything. You know, this is what I currently understand. So thank you for that. I also really enjoyed the imagery that you use, like the bird's nest. I think that's a powerful image that will stay with many of us as we think about this in our daily lives. The piece that I wanted to, you know, I also wanted to thank John for so skillfully arranging these suttas and assigning them out. It's just been remarkable to see how they all play on each other. And there's really been a deepening over the course of the weekend. So I want to thank the conductor behind the scenes here. And the question I had, John kind of foreshadowed a bit. I'm curious what you would say, Ram, that end of the sutta, really interesting line there. Let me see if I can pull it up. Talks about, you know, friends, this is one who neither, kind of got away from the passage when I was looking at something else as someone else was talking about another point. But basically it's saying this is someone who neither, acquires or scatters.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately this is someone who has scattered. So there seemed to be an internal contradiction.
Yeah.
How do you reconcile that internal contradiction?
The way to make sense of that is the beginning says, friends, this is the Dharma practitioner who neither piles up nor scatters form, feeling perception. Mm-hmm. Basically, here's somebody who walks the middle way, mm-hmm. doesn't diminish it, doesn't, and you can take this on the subject of past lives as well. You know, it's not somebody who says, no, there are no such thing as past lives, or, you know, yes, past lives is all there is. He walks the middle way. He realizes that, I've been here before, but this is not me. I'm not identified with this anymore. And this is where, you know, the last mention of scattered, is really, he's scattered away his identification. He just thrown it away. It's no longer there. And there are, and this last sets of three or four is specifically seen as that. A wise practitioner who walks the middle way between denial and clinging, and just sees things as they are.
And that walking of the middle way is scattering, abandoning.
The walking of the middle way is always the Eightfold Path.
It's the Eightfold Path. The Buddhist words where I
teach the Eightfold Path as the middle way between extreme views, such as the extreme view that would place some value in establishing myself in the past or the future. You simply understand the process. And so using that, the English word scatter simply says that we recognize the complete valuelessness of this. And so I scatter it to the wind. It's of no value at all to me. And the other important thing about this, and this is a typical sutta as the Buddha is referring to past and future lives, is to understand this. There, most of modern Buddhism teaches that that you know you're awakened, or awakening maybe, even in that process of awakening, when you start to recount past lives. Almost every modern tradition, certainly every Mahayana tradition, teaches that as a kind of a prerequisite to awakening. You must know your past lives, you must know your future lives, and then other supernatural qualities that are, it depends on the lineage. Some is the ability to transmigrate, to fly around the universe with no body, be able to read minds. Those are all part of this that the Buddha is teaching in this sutta and many others, that it has nothing to do with the Dhamma. Bring your mind back into what's occurring. Don't embellish or diminish what's occurring. And most importantly, don't embellish or diminish the Dhamma in any way.
I actually had another way that I was also looking at it, and maybe you guys are saying this and I'm just hearing it differently, but to me, when you talk about the aggregates, form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, consciousness, they exist. The problem is when we cling to them.
Yeah.
So when we cling our identity to form, that is the birth of anatta. That is the birth of stress. So we want to scatter our identity and form. So scattering is the opposite of clinging.
Yeah.
It's sort of being used as release ourselves, our views of self from form. We want to release our view of self from feeling. We don't want to say, this is my feeling, this is my form. It's just form.
That was outstanding, Jen.
Yeah, thank you. There's also the part where we need to be careful not to deny these aggregates. Because that, you know, that's a common thing. You know, I don't want to have these feelings.
Yeah.
Right. Feelings are there.
Which is really a denial of the clinging part of the clinging aggregates.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, the when we see the aggregates as they really are, every human being is made up of form, feeling, perception, fabrications, and consciousness. It's when we cling fabricated ideas to the form, to the feeling, to the perceptions, that we use that as the vehicle to continue ignorance. So the five clinging the five aggregates are completely impersonal and dispassionate aspects of human life, except what we do to manipulate them to create fake identities for ourselves, to diminish and embellish. That's why we get stuck in the aggregates. That's why we cling to the aggregates, because we're constantly in a process of diminishing and embellishing what's occurring right now.
Yeah, I'm on the same page. I liked how Jen just described that. This is why it's so strange to me, this line. This friend is a Dhamma practitioner who neither clings to nor abandons. I would think it'd just be clear to say, this is a Dhamma practitioner who does not cling to, and is one who is now established having abandoned.
Yeah, it's very subtle, Trevor. Yeah. Picked up on that. It's very subtle, but he's saying, like John just said, we have to understand we have five aggregates now that are imbued with wisdom to not crave for establishment or cling them together, and that's sort of pointing us back to that unbinding and scattering. Yeah. They're kind of the same concept there.
That's what the Buddha is saying. The accomplished Dhamma practitioner is simply not engaged in the process of maintaining a fake views of self. We're not even in the process anymore of recognizing and abandoning it, because we're past that. It's not like it's not part of Dhamma practice. It's simply not part of this accomplished Dhamma practitioner anymore. There's no need for
just understanding.
There's nothing left to provoke the need for that. I'm sorry, David.
Isn't that just understanding?
Yeah.
But
as Kevin pointed, it's understanding that has led to unbinding. So there's nothing, since complete unbinding has occurred, there's nothing left to diminish or embellish. There's nothing left to scatter or to acquire. The task is done. And so when the task of awakening is done by a human being, what's left? Well, what's left is not unenduring annihilation. What's left is a human life now. You know, that's something that when you're engaged in speculative spiritual chasing, the end result isn't a human life, is it? It's something outside of it, something that is diminished or embellished. But the Buddha teaches us how to have a human life. So the end result isn't escape. It's not past or future. It's actually being involved in the thing that human beings want to avoid, moment by moment life. Do you see? I mean, this is the sutta and the Buddha's Dhamma, but this sutta gets to the heart of the contradiction between what an awakened human being taught and what everybody else believes in.
Mike?
Well, just jumping in on this, and John, anyone and everyone, just comment on this. But once we understand the aggregates for what they are, okay, the mind reunites with the body because the aggregates are a distraction to the mind, ultimately.
Yeah. Good way to put it. Yeah. And it's the convenient vehicle we as human beings who are ignorant of Four Noble Truths create this vehicle that, because of what it gives us. You know, I learned many years ago, I can't remember who it was, I do remember who it was, but it's not important. It had to do with, I don't want to get too deep into it. How do you relate to people when you're... Well, it's what we do as Dharma. How do you relate to people when you're trying to help them? You have to be mindfully present with someone in order to really be of value, no matter what it is. You know, if you're an auto mechanic, you still have to be present to listen to what people are saying about the noise in their car. You can't be daydreaming. You have to be present to live your life. This is what the Buddha's teaching. This is what Ram brought out so wonderfully. You got to be in it. You got to be in it. And if you're in it, then you can win it. But you got to be in it. If you're stuck in the past, if you're stuck in the future, if you're adding to or taking away from what's occurring in this moment, you're not here. You've literally lost your mind. And so again, the Buddha taught a way to scatter our ignorance and reunite a mind in its body and keep it there.
Refine mindfulness, yes?
Yeah. But it really teaches, and one thing that Brahm brought out is the true refuge nature of what the Buddha is teaching. Because we put aside everything else. This idea of refuge has its significance to me because of my little bit of Hawaiian background. In the old days, when those things that we're so happy to hate, those old white men were going to Hawaii and taking over the islands, they came across a group of people that had, and much like northern India was during the Buddha's time, there was a bunch of little kingdoms. Each island had a kingdom. The big island at one time, I think, had 9 different kingdoms. And they were always at war with each other. But they figured out this civilized way of warfare. That if someone had gotten to the point where they just so sick and tired of fighting, if they could get to a place called a city of refuge, and they're still there on the islands, Kevin knows about these places. If you can make your way to one of these cities of refuges, you were safe until the conflict was over, and then you could go back into the community and you were repatriated. It was one of the most sensible things I think ever done in warfare. If you had enough, you could get out of it. But there were very difficult places to be. One place on the big island called Po'o'onu'u Honaunau, you had to actually swim through shark-infested waters to get to this place on the island. But once you got there, nobody could touch you. The Buddhist Dhamma is that way, isn't it? We have to swim through these shark-infested waters of our own making. But once we get there, once we put aside the need to embellish this moment, I have established this true refuge for me, and I've established it in the Dhamma. And we've all done that. And so I bet you would all say that you've deepened your understanding of what true refuge means. Yes, no?
Yep.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Every bit at a time.
And it's just like Ram described. It's just that way. It's just by putting your mind where it belongs. Not in some speculative past or future acquisition. Or as Jen pointed out yesterday, these ideas of infinite consciousness or anything else. But that's also, just to make the point, I'm sorry, Ram, I'm taking over your teaching session. The belief of establishing myself in a past or a better future life or in Buddha nature or Buddhahood or infinite consciousness or the perception, or the dimension of neither perception or non-perception is the same as insisting that I have to be the world's best meditation teacher. It's all a speculation. So those flowery terms tend to get our attention, but anytime we try to establish ourselves in a fabricated way in the world, we're doing that process. The Buddha says, recognize and abandon it, like Ram said, like your hair is on fire. You know, that's the problem.
Couldn't you summarize that by explaining it as craving for self-establishment?
Yep.
Craving.
It's a second noble truth.
Yeah, that it really is something to, I mean, every time we sort of go through this, I always just come back to craving and how deep that really goes. We've talked a lot about 5 clinging aggregates and sort of this physical orientation of this process. But deeper than that is the craving to actually establish a self before the physical. I mean, we we're talking about this. The Buddha's talking about past lives or this lives. That's all done here. That's right here. We're either putting ourselves there, putting ourselves somewhere else, and then in turn, we feel from that. We have a physical.
And this thing with past lives specifically talk to self-identification.
Of course it does, because it's all speculation.
It's
Trevor brought something up yesterday about birth. It's why the Buddha didn't teach physical birth, because everyone knows how physical birth takes place. We do, don't we? I mean, we're here. That's the point, is that what is obvious should be left obvious. I don't need, as the teacher, to explain birth because I'm here. It's the best explanation of birth is that we actually had a birth and we're living it. So to get into where it came from and why we have it and how we can manipulate future ones is and has to be pure speculation. It has nothing to do with Four Noble Truths, meaning what's occurring right now. And so one of the reasons why the Buddha emphasized this so much, not in many, many suttas, is because it was such a common teaching of his time too, that it was distracting, just like it is. And if you look at, I can't think of one religion that it doesn't fit this bill, that the ultimate culmination of whatever the religion is, maybe some pagan religions I'm not thinking of, is an establishment in some speculative realm, whether it's a Christian heaven or a Buddhist Tulsita heaven or a Buddhist Buddha nature or nothingness or emptiness, or the one of the religions with the virgins that you all get, you know, yeah, whatever. Right. Yeah. So they all provide the distraction of some reward. If I could just believe in it, then I can get that speculative reward. Now, what have I done? I've lost my life. So one of the things that turned me off to, I was brought up Roman Catholic, was just that I was taught constantly that I do these things, and if you do them for your whole life, when you die, you're going to get something really good. But I wanted to know, what about now? You know, what do I get now? Where's my life now? I don't want to live a life for some future life. And even at 8, 9, 10, 12 years old, that bothered me. I didn't understand it. But all that I ever really wanted was to learn, how do I live my life? And it wasn't until I came across Four Noble Truths that I found out how to do it. And this is it. This is the life. I don't need to know where I came from, because I know where I came from. Where I came from put me right here. And I don't know where I'm going because I don't know where I'm going. But I do know where I am. I'm right here and right now. What a wonderful place to be. What a true refuge, isn't it? For when my mind has become so distorted that it's either stuck in the past or stuck in the future, what am I to do? Well, I found out what to do. I'm back. Yeah. Take to it like my hair's on fire. We always, this refuge is, I guess what the point that I'm making with this little speech is, the refuge that we hope to establish is always here. We just have to take a breath and enter it again, over and over and over again. Whether it's that metaphor of the city of refuges back in old Hawaii or right here, right now, today. What a refuge. And we are, I think all of you would agree that right now we're experiencing the triple refuge, the three jewels of the Buddha, his teachings, and this wonderful Sangha, right?
It's all there.
It's not a stretch, is it?
Thank you, Sangha.
This is it. This is the Dhamma. We've established it and we've deepened it. And we've done it in the simplest way possible, by practice. So someone asks you, how do you develop the Buddha's Dhamma? It's just like this, by doing it. I'm sorry, Ram, I took over your session.
That's okay. Just wanted to check on Karen. You seem to be well established there in your refuge.
Hi. Oh, so Ram, thank you so much. You know, I too agree that your pace was just what I needed. I consider myself a slow learner, especially when it comes to concepts that are new to me, which is why I asked yesterday about the recording, because I really look forward to going back and listening to everyone again, because I know I felt and feel that there's so much here from each of you teachers. It's just been brilliant to have this gift of so many interpretations and so much wisdom. I felt that something clicked, a new understanding, a deeper understanding of the aggregates, and so I really appreciate that. There was something else I wanted to say, and of course I don't remember it. So just thank you, thank you, thank you.
Mm. As to the cadence, part of that is because of the voice of Lorna in the back of my head.
Oh, no. Oh, there was another thing. You were talking about being a teacher forces you to be a practitioner. I mean, I feel that way about my yoga. I can't possibly stand up in front of a class and give them something that I don't have already. Right. So it forces me to continue to develop and learn new things and not become lazy and slack like I might want to. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. Mary, how are you doing there?
I'm doing great. This has been just amazing. So I guess the first thing is, wow, Rom. Wow, and thank you. What a great job you did. And like others have said, the cadence and even the building on of what Kevin said, this conversation, you know, what Jen's added, what everybody's added, you know, you never know where someone else is at on this, you know, in our Sangha, right? So you never know how you're going to help someone. But this has really been powerful, and there's been a lot of shifts, and, you know, what David said, what Michael has said, everybody, it's, you know, you said, like, your hair's on fire, because it's been on fire for a really long time.
Yep.
And so some of the fabrications or the clinging aggregates have been that way for a long time, and we have to be fastidious, as you were, in order to prepare for this day. We have to be investigatory and curious minds to do the work, to create meaningful change. I mean, you know, when you have a paradigm shift, which I think I had today, it's like chipping away at cement, you know, of fabrications that have been that way, or aggregates that have clung because you thought that's the way it was supposed to be.
Yeah, and then just then, like, a crack opens up in the cement, and you get your chisel in there, and poof, the two pieces.
Yeah.
Blasted away.
And the power is that when you can break the chain of dependent origination, that the work continues, but there's a falling away, and there's a lighterness and more spaciousness to go forward. So, you know, this has just been very powerful, as powerful as if we were all together. Although I think I'll always prefer to be together. This is very, this has just been very impactful, and everybody has been so thoughtful in, those of you who presented, so thoughtful and caring, like, that has really come across, that you wanted to get your authentic self and your authentic understanding in order to share that with the rest of us where we are. So just thank you so much to each of you, and John, and your vision, and Matt, who's not here, but everybody, just, it's had a wonderful impact. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Becky, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Rom.
Good.
I just want to echo really what everyone else has been saying, that first of all, repetition is the key. And you did a great job of explaining again the basic principles of the Dhamma that were inherent in this sutta. And you were right on. You were as clear as day. And your calm and thoughtful way of speaking was so delightful to listen to. In fact, it was so delightful, it was almost distracting at times, because you were so, just so calm and focused.
Thank you.
And I love,
means a lot.
Well, it was great. And I love your bird's nest metaphor. That Chad did so much to help me visualize the clinging aggregates and how we cling them together and make something out of them that they're not, or that their components are the same as they were before we cling them together, and now we've cling them together into this mass. So that was a great, great metaphor. And since I don't know if I'm the last one to speak, but I had a while to sit here and listen to everyone else. And a lot of my thoughts came together. And I just wrote down a very brief little statement I called it focusing thoughts. And this is what I said: accept it for what it is, a human life, which is pretty awesome if you let yourself live it, if you are present for it, and if you learn to see the noble truth of it.
Thank you.
That's great.
Thank you. Thank you. So that was great. I everything that Mary said, I felt, because I felt this was so awesome for everyone, for all the teachers to hear everyone explain things from a different perspective, and they were so authentic and honest. It was delightful. Yeah. It was truly great. Thank you.
It was a pleasure to do.
Yeah. Great job, Sangha. Way to keep this on the Dhamma. It's just, I think this was new for all of us, and we didn't know where it was going to go, but feels like it's starting to feel like a retreat right here and right here.
Right here.
Yeah, important places there and there.
This is the result of a well-focused Sangha. We're literally inspiring each other. It's remarkable. It really is. I've never seen anything like it. Every one of us. Again, this is how the Buddha described the well-focused Sangha. I don't know if David share yet? I don't remember.
Actually, I was going to call on him. Dave, I know you've thrown a few things in there, but can I have your...
Hey, Ron. Hey.
Thank you.
I spoke before. Just want to thank you for your efforts. I've had the opportunity to room with you on retreats, and I see how you go about your day. And this is not a surprise. And again, I said it yesterday, the stewardship of the Sangha is in good hands, and no better four people could be in charge. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, we're all ready to head for the rest of the day. And then, John, you come back.
Yeah, we'll be back 2:15 for a 2:30 start. And we're going to conclude with a talk on, very similar to this. This talk and all the talks feed into our last talk on dependent origination and the myth of non-duality, or the non-dual myth. But that broad subject relates directly to what we're talking about. Anything that is speculative is not part of the Dhamma, and that's why resting the Dhamma on what the Buddha awakened to, dependent origination, is so important. But we'll get into that this afternoon. Does anybody else have anything else to add? Any concerns? All right. We'll see you at about 2:15.
All right.
Bye, John.
Thank you, Ram. Outstanding.
You're welcome.
Thanks, everybody.
It was a pleasure.
Bye, everybody. Thank you, Ron.
Hi, everybody. Bye. See you this afternoon.
Bye.
Thanks, John.
See y'all. There's an awful lot of shooting going on around here today.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support the continued restoration, preservation, and presentation of the Buddha's Dhamma. If you find benefit here, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.